Right, here we go. Didactic Mind, episode 13, lucky number 13. The importance of choosing wisely. I really didn't want to make this episode, to be honest. Or at least I didn't want to talk about the drama concerning the royal family. But then I saw a post over on Vox Day's blog, our beloved and dreaded Supreme Dark Lord, peace be unto him, Vox Day, where he talked very briefly about the importance of choosing the right woman to marry. That seemed very germane because of developments in, shall we say, the lives of some people around me. I've just been... I'm back from a week and a bit ago, 10 days ago, a little bit more, about 10 days ago, from an engagement ceremony for one of my relatives. And it kind of put things into perspective a little bit about what not to do and how not to get people involved in that sort of decision. And I've also been talking with a couple of my readers about some of the decisions that they're looking to make with their personal lives. You know, it's a very momentous decision. So I thought I might add a few of my own thoughts about the Meghan Markle situation and the fate of young Harry Windsor. He's not that young. He's about my age, actually. So before we proceed, as always, very, very big thank you to all of my loyal readers, all five of them. Now, it's a few more than that by now, actually. I checked the Feedly statistics a while back, and it's up to, I think, 70 subscribers, at least, maybe 80 by now, which doesn't sound like much, but actually for a blog on Feedly, that's very good. And I've got a few more on various syndication sites. I have no idea exactly how many. But there's no question that there is a lot more readership coming in nowadays than there was even towards the tail end of last year. I mean, the daily hits on the blog are going from 600-700 a day to 1,600-1,800 a day on average. And that's how it's been for the last month and a half, almost 2 months now. So clearly, you guys like what I write, you guys appreciate what I do, and I genuinely appreciate and respect that about you guys who read my work. So big thank you to all of you, and a big thank you as well to all of my SoundCloud subscribers who are listening to this, whether it's through the embedded link on my blog or more likely through the SoundCloud app and the SoundCloud website. Really big thanks to you for subscribing and for just listening in. Hopefully this is thought-provoking for you and you get some good value out of it. If you have not already subscribed, please make sure you hit the subscribe button so that you never ever miss a new upload. I aim to upload once a week, and I do try to make this a regular thing. I record on Sundays because it seems like the right day to do a podcast. And basically, it's just me talking for about an hour about whatever interests me at that particular time. I had planned to do one on how ridiculous it is to be a vegan, for instance, today. But I decided to scrap that because I'll probably work the vegan angle in at some point anyway. So before we carry on with this, let me just point out that as far as the royal family goes, I am a monarchist, actually. I do like the idea of royalty being in charge. I do think that a king or queen to subject relationship is probably a better idea than any form of almost any form of unlimited or even limited democracy. And I'll explain why. If you read Hans Hermann Hoppe's great book, Democracy, the God That Failed, the point that this legendary anarcho-libertarian, anarcho-capitalist philosopher makes is that if you look at democracy and the history of democracy throughout its kind of peak period, basically most of the 20th century, particularly the period from about 1920 to 1945, that was really when democracy started taking off as a concept. The history of democracy is extraordinarily poor compared to the history of the monarchies that preceded democratic nations. And the reason for this, as Professor or Dr. Hopper pointed out, is that monarchs had a direct tie to their kingdoms and the welfare of their subjects that modern-day governments do not. And I'll never forget, I mean, I started reading this book years ago, I've never finished it. I just, you know, it gets kind of dry in the middle. But I'll never forget the points that Professor Hopper made in the book at the beginning, where he said that if you look at various indicators of economic well-being and management in particular, the statistics under monarchy, whether absolute or parliamentary, indicate a vastly more healthy and functional economy and culture than anything that has existed in democratic societies since then. If you look at the average rate of interest in most of the European monarchies, it was about 2%. Inflation was low, unless the monarchs decided to debase the currency, which actually was not that common. If you look throughout history, debasing the currency by minting gold coins diluted with baser metals had serious and severe consequences. So monarchs couldn't just do whatever they wanted with the currency. They were beholden to the interests of the banking classes, the merchant classes, and the people themselves. They could not simply do whatever they liked. If you look at the average tax burden, peasants in the Middle Ages complained incessantly about their taxes, and with good reason, because the church would tithe, 10% of everything that they had, and the monarch would tithe another 10% or so of everything that they had. So the average tax burden was about 10%. Again, the church tithes were variable, and the monarch's tithes were also variable because the monarch would basically tithe his tax, his barons and his nobility, and the barons and nobility would then tax the peasants. You know, so it was a diluted form of taxation. It was not direct upon the peasantry. So really, the peasantry operated more with a tax burden from their direct overlords, the nobility, not the king or queen himself or herself. So the average rate of inflation was quite low because most countries were on metallic standards. They were not using paper money. The average tax burden was low. Again, it was only about 10% overall on average. Some were higher, some were a lot lower. It varied from country to country. It is not an exaggeration to say, and I have had bad arguments with people about this, but I stand by my opinion, that European civilization in 1914, just before the outbreak of World War I, was the absolute pinnacle, the apex of human achievement. We have never come close since then to that level of cultural refinement, sophistication, human decency, and artistic expression. Nor have we come anywhere close in terms of the connection between the ruling class and the subjects. So, on the whole, I do view monarchy as a generally good thing, because it is essentially reflective of the role that God plays as our sovereign. And I believe this as a Christian. God is sovereign. He rules all. That does not mean this is where I strongly disagree with Calvinists, who I think are totally misguided. That does not mean that God controls all decisions. That is a complete misunderstanding of sovereign. But God does get involved in the big decisions, and that percolates down to the little decisions, obviously. Now, with that in mind, seeing as how I am indeed a monarchist, why do I care about what happens to the British royal family? After all, they have nothing whatsoever to do with me. The British royal family has no impact upon me personally. They do not get involved in any form of government at any level, in any country in which I live or have interests in. They are not involved in the American system of government at all. They are not involved in the British system of government except at a relatively superficial level. And they certainly are not involved in any of the Asian countries that I have spent time in. They are not involved in any Eastern European country that I have spent time in. So why do I care? I care because I am basically an Anglophile as well. I am a big fan of the British people, of the English people in particular, not just British, because the British people as a whole are all sorts of mixed up. But I genuinely like England. I like Scotland. I like Wales. I've been to Wales. I've never been to Ireland. But from what I've seen of the British Isles, I really like what I see. It's a beautiful country with a very remarkable people, whom I respect very much. I respect their achievements as empire builders, as governors, as statesmen, as warfighters, of course, and as artists, intellectuals, engineers, philosophers. You know, you name it. I mean, the world as we know it today would not exist without Britain. So, given the part that the English royal families have played in British history, and it is an enormous part, I have great respect for the institution of the British monarchy. But more than that, I care because the lesson of Meghan Markle and young, again, not that young, he's my age, Harry Windsor, are highly instructive to young men everywhere. Now, back when the engagement between Meghan Markle and Prince Harry was announced, I wrote a post on my blog. I think it was either, it was actually around their wedding, in fact, but I've been thinking about this for a while. I wrote a post on my blog where I basically said that this is a disaster in the making, and that Meghan Markle is extraordinarily poorly suited to be the wife of a man directly in the line of succession to the English throne, the British throne. And I listed out my reasons, and I basically agreed thoroughly with a post from much earlier, I think, by, again, His Voxness, our beloved and dreaded Supreme Dark Lord, peace be unto him, Vox Day, in which he basically called Meghan Markle the half-blood princess, which was hysterical. It was brutally effective rhetoric and absolutely true as well, as all good rhetoric should be. So what he pointed out there was that Harry Windsor was a young man, was and is a young man, whose sociosexual rank is completely out of whack. It's totally out of kilter with where it should be. His preferences or his habits don't make sense given his sociosexual rank. And I expanded upon that point a bit in my post. And what I said was essentially that if you look at who Harry Windsor is these days, he is an immensely admirable young man. Now, this was a kid at the age of 12. You know, his mother was killed in the most awful public, you know, media-centered way possible, and he had to endure the emotional damage of walking behind his mother's coffin in full view of millions upon millions of people. Well over a billion people must have watched that telecast of him and his older brother walking behind their mother's coffin on the way to a state funeral. I can't even imagine what that would do to a young man. But what it apparently did to him was turn him into a bit of a rebel, and an indisciplined one at that. He was never particularly intellectually inclined to begin with, and was never interested in applying himself to anything seriously. He already knew and had known for a long time that his older brother would inherit the throne, so he just wanted to be himself, but he couldn't be because he was a royal. So he rebelled in the only ways that he knew how. You know, he was a party animal. He would drink, he would smoke, he would make staggeringly poor decisions about where he was seen in public and with whom and how, given that whole row about him wearing Nazi memorabilia when he was much younger, dressing up as basically Adolf Hitler in a Halloween party costume, and being photographed, you know, in that state. But he turned his life around. He entered into military service after it became very clear that really there was nothing else that he was interested in. He was only really interested in playing sports and having a good time. And in the army, he was able to do both. You know, he was able to bond with fellow men, and he was able to really become someone. He was able to forge an identity for himself as a combat pilot in the army, flying helicopters. So this young man really grew up very quickly and became a truly admirable, courageous, just exceptionally, genuinely good and decent guy. At least so it seemed at the time. And when he left the army, he didn't do so because he wanted to. He actually wanted to fly in combat, but his superiors said, no, it's too risky. We cannot risk you getting shot down, getting captured by the Taliban, and being ransomed out, and you know, that would just be a colossal humiliation for the British people and the British crown, which is true. It absolutely would be. So he had to leave the army, and that really broke his heart. But he created a number of charitable foundations events, particularly the Invictus Games, which were focused around helping wounded veterans regain a sense of purpose and competitive spirit in their lives. And the press coverage was just, you know, wall-to-wall adulation, as it should have been, because this was a genuinely good guy trying to do genuinely good things for the people that mattered the most. You know, the British veterans who had... There's, you know, Americans talk about how they have a serious homeless veteran problem, and it's true, Americans do. It's just... It enrages me to see what... as I did in New York City when I was living near there for a long time, absolutely made my blood boil to see men who had fought and sacrificed and bled so much in the sandbox and the rock pile coming back to the U.S. and, you know, they're living on the streets. I mean, what kind of a country treats its heroes like that? What kind of a country does that? That's just it's disgusting on every level that a country would treat the men who have fought and died for it and lost their brothers and lost their limbs like that. And if that's how America treats its veterans, Britain is even worse. I mean, far worse. The social compact between the British people and the military has broken down effectively. And that's, you know, that's not me saying that. That's what a lot of ex-servicemen are saying. And they're right. So when a royal like Harry comes along, who's actually served in a combat zone, and puts together a set of competitive games with great fanfare to raise funds and awareness for wounded veterans, that's an amazing thing. That's a wonderful thing. And he deserved every last bit of praise that he got for it. You know, it's just an astonishingly good and decent thing to do. And I admired him greatly for it. But then in 2016 or thereabouts, I think it was, it all kind of went, oh, maybe earlier than that, or later than that, sorry, 2018, something like that. It all went way off the rails because after a long history of dating tall, slim, big-breasted or relatively big-breasted blondes and brunettes and a few raven-haired beauties as well, and a couple of redheads. I think there's quite a long history of dating conquests of young Harry Windsor. He settled instead on wanting to marry an already divorced older actress, American actress, from a B-grade movie series, TV series called Suits. It's like, what the hell was he thinking? And the more we found out about this Meghan Markle woman, the more it was like those of us in the manosphere who recognize and understand these things, the more we just said, what the hell is this guy thinking? Because he was violating every single cardinal rule of game. He was marrying a woman who's older than he is. Okay, that's a big mistake. He was looking for someone outside of his own race. Not a catastrophic mistake, but, you know, can cause problems. He was marrying a woman who's already been divorced. Huge mistake. I mean, you know, she might as well have had, like, flashing signs and you know, lights and sirens around her, warning him off. He was going to marry a woman with an unknown past when it came to romantic attachments. And once her dating history began to come out, it became very clear that this was a woman who'd ridden the carousel pretty damned hard. And he wanted to marry a woman who had a history of using and discarding people. Now, not every item on that list is a deal breaker. I mean, I, for instance, have dated and am dating women outside of my own race. That's not, you know, in any way a problem. I mean, I come from a mixed race background myself. It just doesn't really matter that much. It's not a big deal. It's really between the two people involved. But, make no mistake, it does cause problems. It causes complications. When you date outside of your own race and your own culture, it causes problems. Make no mistake about that. Anybody who is Asian and has tried to date Eastern European women, or is American and has tried to date Asian women, or is Western European and tries to date Eastern European women, you know, the culture clashes pop up all the time because the cultures are so completely different. And it causes no end of headaches and hassles. You know, Eastern European women, for instance, particularly in Russia, think that South Asian men are really stupid and creepy, and you know, Russian people in general, for instance, think of Indians as being pretty stupid. They have very little respect for Indians as a whole. They treat Indians with a sort of polite disdain. It's like, yeah, okay, I mean, you come from a shithole country, we don't really care about you. You can come to Russia, you can come to visit, sure, just don't make a nuisance of yourselves, and don't act like idiots. And by the way, if you obey their norms and you obey their laws, Russian people are some of the most friendly, decent, caring, you know, just outstanding people you could possibly hope to know. In all of my time in Russia, I spent over 6 months there total, I think, by now, I have never once felt as though I was being discriminated against because of my race, ever. I am brown-skinned. I have never, ever, ever felt as though I was treated badly because of that. I was invited to a wedding by a lily-white cast of characters, all of them, you know, white Eastern Europeans. It was a small wedding. I was very obviously a complete outsider. I mean, it wasn't, like, I could not have stuck out more than I already did. it wasn't possible. But, you know, the people there, the guys there in particular, treated me with every possible courtesy. Once I had a few drinks with them, I was practically their blood brother. Race really doesn't matter that much once you get past the cultural hang-ups, which are huge, make no mistake. There are problems involved. But the other stuff, you know, marrying a woman who's already been divorced once, marrying a woman who's had a lot of sexual conquests in her past or has been with a lot of guys, you know, anything above really 4 or 5 and you're into serious warning territory. With the caveat that, you know, you have to ask what her past relationships were like. I mean, if she's had 10 relationships, let's say, if she's been with 10 guys, and each one of those relationships lasted, you know, a couple of years at a time, then there's a pattern being established there, potentially problematic. If, on the other hand, she's been with 4 or 5 guys, then it's not great, but if those relationships have lasted a long time, then you're looking at somebody who is good relationship material, potentially. Again, I'm talking about this from the perspective of, you know, a very secular perspective right now. This is not a Christian perspective on marriage. A Christian perspective on marriage is much more strict and much more limiting. So, you know, for those of you who are looking on that perspective of marriage, everything I'm saying is like, is way too lenient. But with this particular case of Harry Windsor, I mean, that perspective doesn't even enter into things. It's not even part of the discussion. Because obviously he has been with a lot of women in his past, and Meghan Markle has been with a lot of men, apparently. Because, you know, I don't want to get sued, but that's just, that's what the Daily Mail tells us, judging by its report on the number of boyfriends she's had, or at least the number of dates, quote-unquote, that she's been on. So, you know, given that she's an actress in Hollywood, well, you know, draw your own conclusions. Or, you know, wants to be in Hollywood. Draw your own conclusions about what that means. But even more importantly than that is the fact that Meghan Markle has a history of using and abusing people that she's been close to. I mean, this is a distressingly common feature in gold diggers, socialites, social climbers, and other ne'er-do-well characters who, you know, they have a track record of getting what they want out of people and then kind of forgetting those people existed. This is a huge red flag, because even with a woman who's been with a lot of guys, if she's loyal to you in your relationship with her and she's modest and careful and, you know, she's supportive of you, she loves you a lot, she cares about you, she doesn't flirt with other guys around you, she doesn't, you know, even when she's not around you, she doesn't flirt with other guys. If she's loyal to you, I mean, that's the most important test of a good woman, is she loyal to you? But that's not to say that that's the only factor, because there are plenty of others involved. Is she loyal to you when things are bad? That's the really important test. When things are really bad, is she the one standing by your side and helping you out? If she is, then she's worth her weight in gold. If she doesn't, if she's the one causing those hard times, get the hell out. No, that's just a simple heuristic. If she's the one causing the hard times, and she's also the one causing you a lot of grief during those times, she is a disaster, and you need to leave as fast as possible. So, with Prince Harry's marriage, there was a lot of joy and celebration about how this was going to bring the royal family up to date, this was going to modernize things. At long last, there was a non-white member of the royal family, and this was somehow seen as a good thing, because it represented modern, cosmopolitan, you know, melting pot Britain. Never mind that it has never been conclusively established whether a melting pot is good for society. A lot of people argue that America is a melting pot. I disagree, because it takes quite a long time for cultures to meld together in a melting pot. And it works a hell of a lot better if the cultures are basically similar than if they are radically different. It has never been conclusively established that a melting pot can effectively and properly melt Western civilized nations, such as the Anglo-Saxon peoples, and the Dutch Protestants, and the Scots and the Irish, with Italians and Germans thrown into the mix, and Swedes and Finns, and a lot of Spanish people. It has never been conclusively proven that that can be melded effectively on its own when you add in the presence of, let's say, Africans from particularly sub-Saharan Africa, or Somalians, or Arabs, or South Asians, or large quantities of Chinese. That has never been conclusively proven, and it still isn't conclusively proven. It certainly isn't conclusively proven that you can melt together a lot of different peoples from, let's say, south of the American border, you know, Hispanics. What has been conclusively proven, pretty much beyond a doubt, by even the most liberal of liberals, is that a melting pot in which you increase diversity also decreases social trust. And this is disastrous. There's no question of that. Robert Putnam's landmark work on the subject horrified him so much that he actually hid his own conclusions. He sat on his conclusions for years, even after he released the data, because he was just so, you know, horrified by what he saw. So this idea that a melting pot is a good thing, a multicultural society is a good thing, is not at all conclusively proven, and if anything, the evidence tells us that it's a terrible idea. So there was no good reason to celebrate the marriage of the half-blood princess to Prince Harry on that basis alone. It just didn't make any sense. But, you know, euphoria and rhetoric tend to trump facts. That's just the reality. There was a lot of euphoria surrounding that wedding, and with good reason. I mean, a wedding is a wonderful thing, unless you have genuine reason to be skeptical. There's no need to be churlish and say that a wedding is going to fail, or to think that it's, you know, wish ill upon the couple. Unfortunately, in this particular case, there was a lot of reason to think that it was going to fail. And those reasons became very clear very quickly. It became very clear that Meghan Markle wanted to do things her own way. She wasn't interested in doing things the royal family's way. She wasn't interested in fitting in. She wanted to create her own brand, her own identity, in a notoriously stuffy, straight-laced, traditional, hidebound institution, which is all of those things for very good reasons. It's supposed to be like that. The entire point of a monarchy is to preserve the cultural and historical legacy of a nation. If you're in the business of preserving things, you're not going to change very fast. That's a good thing, because it represents continuity through the generations, through the ages. That is exactly what you want a monarchy to do. You want it to represent the continuity of your nation, of your people. The monarchy's job in any particular country is to be the exemplar of what it means to be a member of that country, that nation. Okay? Meghan Markle was not of that nation. She was not born in it. She was not involved in it. Her history is not of the British people. She is not a British woman herself in any way, shape, or form. And simply marrying into a British family does not make her British. Okay. Therein lies another big lesson for young men everywhere. You have to understand that no matter what, it's not just two people getting married. It's also two families getting kind of coming together. And it's not always going to work very well because, you know, for whatever reason, one family may not like the other and vice versa, right? There's no avoiding that fact. Family politics always get involved, and it's always quite ugly and brutal whenever it does. So that's not to say it can't be worked through, because, you know, it can be. But when a woman marries into a man's family, she marries into the family. She leaves her own family behind and kind of becomes part of his. And when a man marries a woman, he leaves his mother and father behind and creates a new family unit with her. But he's still very much part of his family tradition, his legacy, his posterity. So when Meghan Markle came in, she really tried to change Harry's family to suit her needs. And that wasn't going to happen. She made it clear that she was going to use her position as a royal to speak out on woke, current-day political issues. The royals don't do that. They are studiously neutral in all issues concerning politics, because they have to be. The royal family depends on the taxpayer. If the taxpayers don't like their politics, they stop paying for the royal family and will call for their abolition. Pissing off Labour voters by supporting Conservatives in the North is a great way to lose out on tax dollars from the North. Pissing off Conservatives in the South and the Midlands is a great way to lose tax dollars from those people. The royal family knows and understands where its bread is buttered. It understands that it needs to show up and do the dreary, kind of boring, pressing flesh and just cutting ribbons. I mean, I know this because I've seen it happen. I was there in 2004 in London when Princess Anne showed up to open the refurbished dorm. It was a big dormitory that I was in at the time. I was there for university. And I actually saw Princess Anne from about 30 feet away. Yeah, seemed like a nice elderly lady. I didn't say a word to her. I didn't, you know, hear any. She didn't say anything to us. I was standing with a group of friends. She simply smiled and nodded in our direction, which was pretty cool, I thought. But I have seen Princess Anne show up to cut a ribbon and, you know, announce, yes, this, I hereby pronounce this hall open for students, or whatever it was. So I've seen the royal family do this stuff. They genuinely do care about the people. They show up for these events, rain or shine, snow or hail. They show up, they do their job, they do it quietly, they do it without fanfare, they get on with the business of showing up for their people. That's a good thing. Meghan obviously didn't want that. She wanted the celebrity lifestyle that she had been aiming towards all her life, which now she had, because she married a prince. So it was an inevitable culture clash. The lesson here is very simple. Don't marry a woman you don't know and who isn't going to be compatible with your desired lifestyle. It is possible to marry a woman or a man who, you know, for women looking to marry men, let's be clear. Let's sort that out right now. I am not interested in talking about chocolatiers and homos. You know, they do their thing. They stay on their side of the street. That's up to them. I'm talking about men who want to marry women and women who want to marry men. Okay. It is possible to get married and stay married to someone else who, when you don't fully agree with or even care about their family, you don't get along with their family. Okay, I mean, I've seen that happen. I've had that experience in my own family. Marriage is a complicated and difficult process, but it's a process. You can work through it over time. You can build a future together, a life together. Because ultimately what you're doing is creating a family unit, a new family unit. And you have to do that between the two of you. You have to make it work between the two of you. But it becomes exponentially more difficult when you bring in the added pressures of public scrutiny and significant, you know, public profiles and tax-supported estates which rely on the goodwill of other people. If you're just two private citizens getting married, well, that's a different story. You know, do what you want to do. But when you are a public figure with tremendous cultural impact, it's not really your marriage anymore. You're a representative for your people. And the moment that you do this, you know, you expose yourself to a lot of criticism. I mean, people forget these days, because of just how much publicity Meghan Markle has received, how much criticism Prince William got back in the day for marrying a middle-class non-royal by the name of Kate Middleton. They were called, Kate Middleton's family was called the Nice to Meet You Middletons, very derisively, because in stuffy upper-crust circles in the UK, the blue bloods all greet each other by saying, how do you do, how do you do, how do you do, so on and so forth. If you've ever watched a terrific series called To the Manor Born, which is hysterically good comedy, very, very upper-class, you know, personalities, personas, and so on, then you will see what their mannerisms are like. They shake each other's hands very stiffly. They say, how do you do? That is the standard greeting among royalty with each other and among stiff-arsed Brits, as the derisory term goes. Kate Middleton got a lot of stick for not being a royal, not being of royal blood, being a commoner. Her family got a lot of stick for being commoners. Prince William got a lot of stick for having a rather grumpy temper, for being very short with the press. But over time, it's become very clear that Kate and William work. Why? Because they're temperamentally very similar. Because Kate Middleton understood very clearly that her role was going to be that of a future Queen of England. Because she understood that her job was to make sure that she never ever made her adopted family look bad. That she never ever tried to make her husband look bad. That she was in it for the long haul. That this was a guy that she'd been dating for a long time. And she was the one who needed to put pressure on him to make a move, and so, you know, she did. I mean, she broke up with him for a few weeks or a couple of months and made sure that she was seen out in public with some guy that, you know, some poor hapless fool that she strung along, and made William deeply jealous and realized that he'd made a huge mistake. And he got her back and married her, put a ring on it, and they've been actually really happy ever since. I mean, they have three beautiful children. They are obviously deeply in love, very affectionate with each other. They carry themselves very well. They've adapted to their roles very well. They have done exactly what needed to be done. And that is why they are spoken of so approvingly these days, because they are very well respected, very well liked. They never do anything to show up the Queen. They never ever do anything to cast the monarchy in a bad light. They show up, they do the job, they get on with it. This is very much to the good. Prince Harry, on the other hand, has never seemed to be particularly comfortable with his royal status. And he married a woman who is really just, I mean, it wouldn't make sense given his sociosexual rank. Let's be clear. Harry Windsor is at least a putative alpha. This guy is somebody who could have any woman he wants. He's incredibly socially successful. He's a prince, for crying out loud. You can't get any more socially successful than that. Billionaires don't have the same kind of social cachet that a prince of England does. He's extremely sexually successful. If you look at the list of his former girlfriends, I mean, they're as long as my arm, and it's just, you know, one gorgeous blonde or brunette after another, and a couple of women with black hair, as I said before, a couple of raven-haired beauties. Lots and lots and lots of very high-quality tail, okay? And I'm sorry to put it in such crude terms, but it's true. So this is a guy who really is an alpha male, or at least he should be, but he's not. His older brother is very clearly a Bravo. He's married a woman who is pretty much exactly the same, you know, level that he is in terms of the looks and the social. Actually, she married up, and he kind of married down, which is fine. I mean, their relationship works because it's a functional, healthy one of a Bravo marrying someone who's, you know, aiming to move up a notch or two. And it functions for that reason. It's a working relationship for that exact reason. With Meghan Markle and Harry, it was never like that. Harry was right at the top of the sociosexual heap. And he married a divorced woman who's been well-ridden on the carousel, who's an actress and therefore something of an attention seeker, a very left-wing celebrity. I mean, what? What the hell? What was he thinking? The answer is that he never really got over his mother's death. And, you know, look, you can't expect a man to do that. You can't. You can't expect a man to let go of something like that. It can't be done. You can only expect him to try to shoulder the burden of that grief and carry on somehow and honor her memory, which is what he's been doing to his great credit all of his life. But he's not done anywhere near a good enough job of fixing his own problems, his own insecurities. And that is another key lesson for all of you listening. If you don't get a handle on your own insecurities, your woman's going to eat you alive. I speak from personal experience. All of my listeners, all my male listeners who have enough self-awareness will be able to do the same thing. They'll be able to tell you that if you're with a woman who, particularly if she's much more experienced than you are in relationships and matters of the heart, and you don't get a handle on your own insecurities and you don't grow up very quickly, you're going to be in all sorts of trouble because she's going to run rings around you. And here's how she's going to do it. She'll say something. You'll respond to it in what you think is a very logical and coherent manner. She'll explode, and you'll have no idea why. And you'll get defensive, and you'll try to explain yourself logically. Worst mistake you can make. Women don't think logically in these situations. They explode because they sense weakness. Women can't stand weak men. The moment that they sense that you are weak in your response, they will push you, they will test you, they will realize you are found wanting. They will realize that you don't have the masculine energy that they need to feed off of. And that's the right word. They need to feed off of that energy. A masculine energy creates a feminine energy and sustains it and protects it and nurtures it. And in return, that feminine energy transfers to the masculine, sustains it, feeds it, protects it. This is a very wonderful thing. This is exactly how relationships should work, where the masculine component is balanced out by the feminine component. Neither dominates the other completely. Each supports and sustains the other. When this happens, when the masculine drive to conquer, protect, and strive, achieve, build, is matched by the feminine urge to protect, to nurture, to protect, to sort of maintain in stasis, if you will, to warm, to care for. When these things are balanced out against each other, then you have a really healthy relationship. And when you have fights, you have arguments, you know, you figure out how to get past them. One party will admit he or she is wrong and just say, hey, made a mistake, oops, smile, laugh, chuckle about it a little bit, hug, kiss, have sex afterwards. You know, that's how these disagreements get solved. But if you're a weak man, if you're fundamentally a weak man, your woman's going to sense that you're weak. I mean, they have a sixth sense for this sort of stuff. They're really good at figuring it out. And they will pounce on your weaknesses, and they will ruthlessly exploit them. And they won't even know that they're doing it half the time. The women who do know what they're doing are really dangerous. And every indication is that Meghan Markle knows that she's dealing with a weak man and knows how to exploit him. So this is a dangerous situation for young Harry Windsor. It's a dangerous situation for his family. I fully expect that Meghan will divorce him within 5 years, maybe less, once she finds that being outside the royal family no longer gives her the kind of brand recognition and cachet that she was looking for, which it won't, because she's clearly taken the ticket. She's clearly sold her soul, excuse me, for fame and fortune. She's left behind a long trail of friends who, former friends who used to care about her a lot and now can't stand the sight of her. She's done a lot of damage to a lot of people in her life, including those who should be closest to her, including, you know, her biological family, the people who she's related to by blood. And in no way is she covering herself in any kind of glory.
Excuse me.
So what we're looking at is probably a very messy, very unpleasant situation. And it bears a lot of lessons for every young man listening right now who's thinking of getting married, and I hope that all of you are. I myself am considering it, you know, very seriously. I mean, I do want to get married. I do want to have a family of my own. I do want to have children. I want to have sons. You know, I want to see them grow up. I want to raise them into men. I want to make sure that they don't have the same weaknesses and failures that I've had in my life. And if that's what you're thinking, then that's wonderful. That's great. You know, good for you. I'm telling you right now, you know, go do it. Go find yourself a girl who is going to meet your needs, who is what you're looking for, makes you feel happy. You know, you love her a lot. You care about her. You find her very supportive and comforting and warm to be around. And you can, most importantly, you can handle her when she gets irrational and cranky and stupid, because that's what women are going to do. It's going to happen. So, you know, when you find that woman, make sure that you take your time, learn from Harry Windsor's lessons. Don't just rush into marriage. Take your time, get to know the girl, get to know her family, get to know her parents, get to understand the weaknesses and failures of your own parents, because they will have failures. You're going to go into a relationship with a bunch of subconscious biases that you don't even know you had. And you're not going to realize it until much later in the relationship, when you're like, huh, I didn't even know why I expected that. That doesn't make sense. Why did I expect that? Oh, well, it's because my parents did it this way. Therefore, I always thought that's the way it is. No, it's not always the way it is. Now, here's a really simple, concrete example. If you're used to parents who don't really communicate with each other, they just sort of, you know, one tells the other, hey, get me this from the kitchen. Or not even that, one walks into the kitchen, dad walks in the kitchen, tries to make himself some tea, and he's perfectly capable of doing it, but mom is like, no, you go sit down, I'll do it. And he just ignores her. No, you go sit down, I'll do it. Keeps ignoring her. No, listen, sit down, I'll make your tea. And then he just sort of doesn't respond, just ambles out of the kitchen, sits down on the couch and starts watching TV. And she doesn't say anything, you know, she just looks really angry and frustrated and grumpy. That's because she's suppressing the fury that she feels at being ignored. Women can't stand being ignored. You may think that that's an okay way to treat a woman. And you may think that because your dad did it this way, it's okay to, you know, to your mom. That's what is acceptable and normal with women. You may think it subconsciously. I've done this exact thing. And it has caused blow-ups that I didn't even understand where the hell they came from. I was like, I didn't do anything to cause this explosion. But the reality is I did, because I ignored the woman that I was with. And she took it as a rejection of her attempts to take care of her man. You know, stuff like that, it's small, simple stuff, but it's very important. If you don't pay attention to these things, you're going to find yourself in a relationship with a girl that's genuinely toxic. Because it's going to be toxic for one or both of you. You're going to be doing things that make her just incandescent with rage. And she's not going to be able to tell you because she just suppresses it inside. And that's going to make her sick and angry and frustrated in ways that men can't understand. And she's going to take it out on you eventually. She's going to snap. She's going to get to the point where she can't deal with it anymore. She's going to snap. So, since we've only got a few minutes left, I'll try to wrap it up here and point out, you know, in summary, what not to do, taking Harry Windsor as an object lesson. First, understand who it is you're in a relationship with. I mean, really do your homework. Second, don't get into a relationship with a girl who's been around the block a lot. I've made this mistake. I've regretted it ever since. I'm very happy to report that the woman in question is somebody else's problem. And she's probably making his life miserable. She got married, and you know, poor bastard. I mean, he put the ring on the wrong woman. That's all I can say. She married him for a green card. It's very likely. Understand who you get. You know, understand the background of the woman you're involved with. Understand her family. Try to get to know her family well. See if they accept you. If they do, then that's a very good sign. If your family doesn't accept her, then it's going to be a big problem. It is. It's going to be a big problem. Try not to get too caught up in it. You know, you can make it work if that happens, but understand that it is going to be a huge headache for you in the future. You have to understand whether you're willing to put up with that. If you are going to date outside of your race, and a lot of you are going to do that, understand that that comes with its own set of headaches. Understand that moving outside of your culture is going to be challenging, especially if you're dealing with a different language. It's just, you know, you have to figure out whether that's worth pursuing. If you do, good for you. You know, great, go for it. Different religions, different politics, different ways of looking at the world. These are important, but fundamentally, if you share the same value set, then you're probably in good shape. If you don't, you're in very, very bad shape. So, that is it for this episode of Didactic Mind, episode 13, as I said. Once again, hit the subscribe button if you haven't done so already. Like this podcast if you enjoyed what you heard. Leave a comment here on SoundCloud or over on the blog. And I will see you for the next one. Take care.